Fudge.
Please stand. Ready to begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, at this time I'd like to introduce our new student representative to the board, Jordan Dean. He's a Marysville High School student.
Thank you. Okay, so the first week of Marysville went very smoothly. The freshmen have adjusted very good to the high school setting. I'm very proud of them. This week we're having our very first rally. It's a welcome back for the students and the newcomers as freshmen. We also will be having our very first welcome back dance that will be held in the quad for the very first time in some amount of years. The theme for our dance is called MORP. It's a backwards prom. So instead of bringing one date, you bring a bunch of friends and you dress the same. In September, we have our club week, so any students will have the chance to join a club, like our ACC, our Asian Culture Club, the Key Club, our community service, the Interact Club, just any kind of club they'd like to join. That goes on September 10th to the 14th. Our leadership class, we are actually doing a lot of major changes to the school this year, hopefully. Basically, our theme is peace, love, and lead. So we're trying to make a revolution, trying to change where dances are. You know, instead of having them in the cafeteria where it's very hot and nothing for kids to do and it's crowded, we're going to move them over to the ASYCC. So, you know, kids actually have something to do if they don't just want to sit there and dance or, you know, be in the corner. They have some games or, you know, it keeps them eye closer. And, this year we're doing a powder puff for our homecoming, which is October 5th, and the juniors and seniors will only be playing in the powder puff because it's just a lot better and it will be a lot smoother for this year. And that's it. Thank you,
Jordan. Thank you very much. And we'll move on to our presentation from Government Financial Strategies, Jonathan Edwards.
Good evening, I'm Jonathan Edwards from Government Financial Strategies, and I'm here to provide an information update regarding the status of our Series 2012 bond issuance process. First, I'll go over the goals and parameters for the bond sale following up on our July board workshop. We'll look at the updated projected debt service and tax levies, talk about bond sale methods, the issue of disclosure during the bond sale process, and go over the remaining bond issuance schedule. So goals and parameters coming out of the July 9th board workshop. Goals were to issue all or as close to all of the remaining bonds as possible, have as much of the issuance expenses covered by the underwriter as possible, so we preserve as much of the money for facilities projects as we can, and have the bonds be callable or prepayable after 10 years. Our parameters were a maximum bond term of 40 years, and a maximum projected tax levy of $60 per $100,000 of assessed value. Bonds and property taxes, just a reminder that basically bond tax rates are determined each year by taking the required tax collection, which is composed of the upcoming bond payments or debt service payments plus a coverage ratio or reserve, and dividing that by the total assessed valuation in the school district. And then essentially each property pays its pro rata share based on its individual assessed value. So of that formula, the first thing there is the bond payments or required tax collection. Let's look at that first. This chart shows in the dark blue our required tax collection for the Series 2009 bonds. You can see that there. The lighter shaded area is the projected required tax collection for the Series 2012 bonds under the parameters that I'll present to you this evening. So you can see that the payments are delayed, and that's because of a tax rate constraint or parameter that I'll show you in a moment. So the second half of our equation is assessed valuation. This chart shows in the light dashed line on top the pre-election assumed assessed valuation, basically what we assumed prior to the election going in terms of our bond financial plan, where we would be if that had come to fruition. Of course, assessed valuation has not grown as assumed prior to the election. So the bottom line shows in the dark area in the bottom left our actual change in assessed valuation in recent years, and then in the new darker dashed line, the currently assumed long-term change in assessed valuation. So currently, for the purposes of this analysis, we're assuming negative 0.5% in 2013-14. That follows a negative 0.23%, negative 2.3% for 12-13, which actually was a slight improvement compared to the prior year. Then assuming 1% growth for fiscal year 2014-15, 3% in 15-16, and 4.5% annually thereafter. And that would result in the following projected tax levies. So you can see in dark blue the projected tax levies for the Series 2009 bonds. Now the key is here that our projected tax levy for all bonds from this election, Measure P, cannot exceed $60 per $100,000. You can see that the 2009 bonds alone are utilizing almost all of that projected tax levy through the year 2036, approximately. Okay, so that's why we have very little room, should the board wish to proceed on the plan we've discussed, very little room to have any new bond payments coming on the Series 2012 bonds until those 2009 bonds are repaid. Does that kind of make sense? We have very little room there in the tax levy, very little room to add bond payments. After the 2009 bonds are repaid, obviously, we wouldn't have any other debt service. That's when the repayments could occur. So a summary of the details. Again, the legal maximum projected levy is $60 per $100,000. Our current projected maximum is just underneath that. Our legal maximum bond term is 40 years. We're currently projecting a bond term of right around 37. It's actually shown fractionally there just due to the potential timing of this bond sale later this year. And our bond payments would actually be in August, so that's why it's shown like that. The projected bond issuance amount is pretty much the entire $12.56 million that we have authorized. With that, the district believes it could match $10.3 million in state funding that would be required to match that. So there would be, as a result of this bond plan issuance, $22.88 million in funds for facilities projects. The current projected total interest repayment over the term of the bonds is about $72.6 million. In today's dollars, because understanding that we'll be getting our money in today's dollars, it would be paid back over time. As we all know, dollars in the future are worth less than dollars today. So I also wanted to show it to you on a present value basis. In today's dollars, the cost of that interest, cost of the money, would be about $29.54 million. So these numbers are largely consistent with what I presented to you in July, actually slightly better due to some refinements in the bond plan and due to 2012 assessed valuation actually coming in a little bit better than what the information I had in early July, but basically consistent with that. Bond sale methods. There are essentially two basic ways to sell bonds. One is a competitive method, basically a public auction, where we invite underwriters or lenders to submit bids. And the other method is a negotiated sale where the underwriter or lender is selected prior to the sale and the interest rates and bond terms are essentially negotiated with that lender. Generally, a competitive sale process is the financially optimal method for selling school district general obligation bonds. All of our prior bonds have been sold using a competitive sale process. However, we did consider that a 40-year bond term or near to it might require a negotiated sale because it is certainly a longer term than we've looked at in the past. We have researched the question with bond underwriters and received positive feedback so far about a competitive sale. So based on current market conditions, and I'd emphasize that current, we would be recommending a competitive sale process. However, if that process was not successful in achieving the board's goals, then certainly we can look at a negotiated sale at that time. So should the board wish to proceed, one of the documents in your second meeting in September is the preliminary official statement. This is just an example of what the front cover would look like. And this is a disclosure document. There are two primary purposes of the preliminary official statement, or POS. One is it's a method for us to disclose all material facts about the bond to potential bond investors. So it's a prospectus, if you will, for folks who are thinking about potentially investing in these bonds. This document discloses information that would be relevant for them to make an investment decision. The document is also used by us to market the bonds to potential investors, and then in the future, when bondholders want to sell and remarket their bonds, they can use the same document. It's very important that the board review the disclosure document, the preliminary official statement. The Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, has said that in authorizing the issuance of securities and related documents, a public official may not authorize disclosure, the official statement, that the official knows to be false. Nor may a public official authorize disclosure while recklessly disregarding facts that indicate that there is a risk that the disclosure is misleading. So certainly we'd be asking the board to review that document. In reviewing the preliminary official statement, you would see that it's written in a somewhat industry standard format style. That's really for the convenience of the primary audience, who are investors. We have to be careful about providing too much information, as that can obscure more important facts. Of course, we have to be very cognizant of not omitting key relevant information. So as you review that, if anything comes to mind that you'd like to bring to our attention, please pass those comments, questions, thoughts through to staff, and they'll certainly pass them through to us. But as you read this document, you'll see it doesn't exactly read like a John Grisham novel or anything. It's just kind of a legal document, but certainly very important for the board to review, as you have in the past. And finally, our bond issuance schedule, should the board wish to proceed. On September 25th, we'd be asking the board to consider a resolution to authorize the issuance of the bonds. The final comments on the disclosure document would be due on October 5th, scheduled to have the sale on October 17th and close the bond sale at the end of October. So I'm very happy to take any questions.
If I read that right, this assumes that it's at 3% annually, right? Is that locked in, or is that at the bottom there? Next slide. There you go. Now we're two away. Next, there you go. At the bottom, assumes annual interest cost discounted at 3% annually. Is that locked in? Would we have that locked in?
That's purely a number for mathematical calculation purposes. It's not a number that you're locked in. It's just like saying, what is $10 10 years from now worth today? You have to make an assumption about inflation. So that 3%, that's just intended to be purely an assumption about inflation in order to take a future dollar and say, what is that worth in today's dollars? Just as a calculation. So that's just an assumed, what that is a placeholder assumed inflation rate for the purposes of calculating the value of the money in today's dollars. And I use 3%, it's just a pretty standard, normal, long-term inflation rate assumption that I think is in the ballpark of reasonableness.
Okay.
My question is there any other way for us to generate money without this bond sale?
There's not that I'm aware of from this bond measure, or
right,
from any...
Right, not from this bond measure, but is there another way? Could we do another bond that would cost us less than 80, what is it, 80,000? $80 million?
If you went for, let's say that you went for another bond election, a new bond election,
yeah,
then we wouldn't have the $60 constraint anymore, because it would start again for that new
right.
bond election.
Right.
In which case, if we didn't have the $60 constraint and we could have $60 on the 2009 bonds, plus another $60 on a new bond election,
mm-hmm.
then we could easily shorten the term of this borrowing. Now, of course, voters would be paying $120 per $100,000 of assessed value, plus Measure H. So that would certainly, yes, that would certainly decrease the interest cost because the total taxes in the shorter term would be significantly higher.
Right.
Just like a 15-year mortgage is considerably more financially efficient. Like a 15-year mortgage is considerably more financially efficient than a 30, but considerably more expensive from a cash flow
right.
standpoint.
How popular is this 40-year with other school districts that you've worked with throughout the state?
It's something that we're seeing a little more of. We haven't done it a lot. We do anything we can to... I mean, my job as your financial advisor is to implement your borrowings in the most financially efficient way I can that meets your stated goals. So with any client, I always ask, what is it that you're trying to get out? How much money? What bond parameters? Callable, not callable, all of those things. I then deliver the most financially efficient financing we can, but I can't make 2 plus 2 equal 5. So we are doing it a little bit, but always with full disclosure. This is ultimately a board decision. We're completely disclosing the interest components to the board, and that is my job, is to bring you the information and fully disclose the information to the best of my ability.
Knowing your full disclosure, sir, what the people in November 2008 were voting on and were not perceived what is actually happening in 2012, am I reading this right? You're saying that $60 a maximum assessed value? That's a legal maximum?
Yes.
Correct. The maximum projected tax levy legally is $60 per $100,000.
And how many school districts could you even estimate that approve this type of bond issuance?
Well, when you say this type, do you mean a 55% voter approval bond measure that has the $60
yes.
maximum tax levy?
Uh-huh.
And for union school districts, it's $30 per $100,000. That's in the law for 55% voter approval bonds. I would guess there's been hundreds of Proposition 39 55% bond elections in the state since this law was enacted. I do want to clarify, and I apologize if I'm misunderstanding you, that issue is separate from the interest cost issue. The interest cost issue is being driven by circumstances that are constraining our tax rate and our bond payment. So one doesn't necessarily equal the other.
Okay. Thank you.
You have the current projected total interest over the term of the issue. Now, could that fluctuate? Could that be more or less?
Not once we lock it in on the day of sale. Our interest rates will be fixed. This is obviously a projection, but no, our interest rates will be fixed, not variable.
Mark, how does it look for us getting matching funds for the projects? That's pretty dim at the moment, right? So if we sell these bonds and get the money, we may not get the matching funds to build the schools and things that we need, right?
Well, excuse me. Actually, I would disagree with that. We have two projects underway, as you know, one at Oliver's, one at Yuba Feather. We've already received the state matching funds for both projects. The three projects that we have on the current unfunded list, which are Arboga, Ellen, and Linda, are high enough up on the unfunded list that there still is state bond construction money available to make the payments. We cannot access the money until we've signed a construction contract. We can't in good faith sign a construction contract unless we have enough money to complete the construction project. Once we sign those construction projects, and we, based on our current plan, Ellen Arboga would, that would happen in the spring of 2013, then we do expect to get the state matching money, again, because we are high enough up on the unfunded list that there is still current state bond money available for those projects. Now, certainly I'm not going to sit here and tell you that's a 100% guarantee. I can't. But I will tell you, for every project that we have submitted and started and complied with all the rules, we have been paid for. I don't expect these next three projects to be any different. Also, I'd like to interject, obviously the 40-year term is a key issue here. And I would like to ask Jonathan to perhaps elaborate a little bit on what the 10-year call provision means.
So one of the things that we would certainly try and do, if the board wished to proceed, and this is an important parameter, is obviously ideally having the ability to refinance these bonds, prepay them in the future. That flexibility would be important to have, should there be an opportunity to take advantage of that and decrease the cost or term of this bond in the future. We will do our best to incorporate, should the board wish to proceed, to incorporate that feature in the bond issue. As of today, based on current market conditions, we think we can likely do that. But again, even on this schedule, we're a little bit away from getting really close to issuing the bond, and so I couldn't say that with 100% certainty. We certainly would, I do want to assure you that that's something that we would know before the board executes any documents or before, really it's the administration at your, per the resolution you adopt, executes the final purchase agreement for the bonds locking us in. So we wouldn't, for example, if that was significant, we wouldn't have to lock in if we weren't able to achieve that as a parameter if that was a make or break. So to summarize, right now we think we can likely get that. That would provide the potential to refinance or restructure these bonds in the future and ideally decrease the term and or the interest component.
I guess I want to know what the bottom line is. If we had changed our minds on this and we voted no, what happens?
If this doesn't go forward based on the current timeline, we will most likely lose all three projects, Arboga, Ella, and Linda. Our DSA approvals will expire before we can raise the funds to do the projects. Once our DSA approvals expire, we come off the unfunded list. Potentially, we could lose all $10.3 million of the state matching funds. It is possible, with current cash flow, we might be able to do one of the three. I'm not in a position to sit here tonight and tell you that for certain. It is a possibility. So I do need to sit tonight and tell you if the major P bonds are not issued, based on our current schedule, the most likely outcome is we will lose all three of those projects.
And the matching funds.
And the matching funds.
And we're under a time restraint with the matching funds.
We're under time restraint with the matching funds due to the expiration of the DSA approvals. DSA approvals have a shelf life. Once you get a project DSA approved, said a different way, they don't last forever. You can, 4 years. You can get a couple of extensions, and they're good for a maximum of 4 years. We lose our DSA approvals at Arboga and Ella in the summer of 2013. Once we lose those, we've lost our unfunded approval. We've lost our state match. Linda follows in the spring of 2014.
Thank you.
I would like to add to Jonathan's comment, if I may, on the call provision. Again, to me, this is a key provision. after 10 years, if a future board, a future administration, I'm assuming a lot of us may not be here, but that gives that future board the option of refinancing the general obligation bonds. Under current law, the district would not be allowed to pull any cash out of the refinancing for other projects. So the sole purpose would be to refinance the debt so there's an advantage to the taxpayer. Now, again, there's no guarantee in 10 years the district can refinance those general obligation bonds at an advantage to the taxpayers, but you would have the option, and theoretically you would have that option for every year thereafter. So if it didn't work in year 10, it might work in year 12. And of course the point would be, as Jonathan mentioned, to either lower the interest rate or shorten the term, which would be a benefit to the taxpayer.
So we're at a scary point right now. We go forward with this, and we go through with the building plans that are for the future of this district. Or we come to a dead halt with absolutely no guarantees down the road that we could ever go back to the building programs. Is that over-exaggerating, or is that pretty much what it's like?
No, there's clearly there's clearly a decision point here for the board to make, and it is a board decision. It is up to, well, technically it's up to four of you to make the decision, at least four of you to make the decision to go forward or not. If you go forward, then we raise the $12.5 million. We stick to our project timeline. We generate the state matching funds. We move forward. If you decide not to issue the bonds, then again, those three projects go on indefinite hold, and quite honestly, they may never be seen again. Again, it is possible we might be able to move forward with one of the three. At the time that in the future, if the district is then chooses to issue the remainder of the Measure P bonds, we could have different projects, we could have no state matching money available. There's all kinds of variables that there's really no certainty to predict.
No.
No, you based on the current schedule, you would actually vote on September 25th, but we need to give Jonathan and me direction as to what we should do, because Jonathan's firm has work to do, I have work to do, legal counsel has work to do, and we need to know what that direction is from the board.
Jonathan, how are you? You know, let me ask my question correctly. How many other clients that your governmental services has are you using the cabs with?
We have at least one other client that is active, but I think has longer-term cabs. We haven't had to do it a whole lot, but obviously it is being done statewide. My impression is that, you know, in some cases maybe there's been less than full disclosure of all the facts associated with something like this, and certainly there has been in those instances, questions raised. For, as I mentioned, not to beat a dead horse, but my job is to give you the information,
right.
and we've disclosed the information. We're fully upfront about it. I don't mean to sound downplay this, but it is what it is,
yeah.
And I recognize the challenge before the board. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah, you know, looking at this from our perspective as board members, obviously a bond wouldn't pass today if we were asking for a bond in today's climate, today's economic climate. There's no way a bond would pass. Pushing this out 4 years obviously is going to cost the taxpayers a lot of money, a lot of interest. That's the downside. The upside is that we do have a lot of buildings that are in disrepair and need more repair, and eventually the economy will recover. So, you know, that all comes into play. None of us have a crystal ball. None of us know exactly what's going to happen. So us as board members are going to have to, you know, between now and September 25th, really think hard about which way we want to go with this. But we're at the point tonight where we need to let Jonathan and Mark know, are we going to spend any more money on this? Do we need to keep researching it and going forward? You know, that doesn't mean that we're telling them to sell the bonds. That comes on the 25th. But they do need some direction from the board on which way to go at this point.
Well, yeah, technically there'd be 12.56 million options in between, because you have zero or you have issuing the 12.56 million of GO bonds. I believe Jonathan does have some information, and essentially I ask him to split the difference. He does have some information on that that I believe he can share with the board. However, before he shares that information with the board, we will still lose most likely two of the three projects, even if we issue half the bonds. Now, again, it might be possible to save one of the other projects, but I can't sit here today and tell you that's possible. So I would tell you, even with issuing half the bonds, I will shift my earlier statement from we might be able to do one of the three projects to we would be able to do one of the three projects. But I can't sit here and tell you we would be able to do the other two. And then the district would still have unissued Measure P bonds that would then be issued at a future later date. It hasn't come up, but I also did want to mention that general obligation bonds don't impact the general fund. They're not going to help the general fund. They're not going to hurt the general fund. They're not going to increase cuts. They're not going to decrease cuts. They're not related. Issuing general obligation bonds does not threaten the fiscal stability of the district. The voters approved paying ad valorem property taxes necessary to retire the debt on the general obligation bonds. It simply does not impact the general fund. So with that, Jonathan, perhaps you could share that other information.
And just to add on quickly to what Mark said, and I have some information, one of the challenges here is that we do have, you know, competing facts in play. There is an opposite relationship between the term of the bond and the amount of money available for facilities projects, for example. That's an example of why, at a staff level, we would need clear direction from the board as to what the parameters that you would wish to see are, and if they can't be achieved, we don't do it. That's just an example. So as Mark mentioned, there are theoretically thousands of options. But one theoretical option is something in the middle. So if we did a 30-year bond term, again at the $60 maximum projected tax levy, we currently project that we could get from the bond issuance about $6.7 million. And Mr. Allgaier, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that we could match about $4.4 million in state funding with that.
Well, that would depend on which of the projects we proceeded with. They all three have different state funding amounts. And there is a handout. The board's actually seen this handout in the past, but we gave it to you again this evening. So you can see the amount of state funding for each of the three projects, as well as all the money we've received to date.
So we could get about $6.74 million in bond proceeds, possibly some amount, but certainly significantly less, I believe, than the full state funding amount. And in terms of the interest on that, we'd be projecting total interest over the life of the issue of about $28 million. In today's dollars, it's about 13. So the ratio there would be about a little over $4 in interest for every dollar in principal. So a purely from a financial standpoint, a better ratio, a lower interest ratio than the 40-year term, of course. But of course, with less bond proceeds also. About 30 years. I just picked 30 years. These days, most school district GO bonds are in the 25 to 30-year range, as are, quite honestly, non-school district GO bonds. I've worked on a county GO bond that was 30 years, so that's a pretty standard term these days, 25 to 30.
Well, Mr. Edwards, I realize you're going to need direction tonight then and not wait until 9:25, is that correct? And from the whole board, you want sort of like get a feel for what we're thinking?
Yes, because when we come back for official approval to issue the bonds, a resolution, with that will be a whole host of legal documents that need to be written, drafted in a way that describes the bond issuance we're planning to do. Okay. So,
well,
yes.
I personally, as a one voting member, I realize what we might be losing, but I also realize projects are being canceled all over the state due to the economy. Matching funds are very questionable at best at the state on any project, from the Marysville levies to wherever you look. What we're really asking the citizens of Yuba County to do is to take on an incredibly large new tax that I can't, in all good consciousness, ask them to do. This is not 2008. This is 2012, and I don't see things getting better. So that is my feelings, and I think you got to drift on how I'm going to vote.
On the other hand, if you buy a house, you know, over 30 years, you're paying for it 2.5 times usually your original price was. The question is, can we not move forward? If we don't move forward on this, we lose two of our three projects at least. Okay, whereas we don't want to get bumped off the list of the state, and it's also the matching funds of the state. It's not just the $22 million or $23 million. It's what the state will match with us. So.
No, it's half that.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry.
And that doesn't come with guarantees.
Yeah. So the matching part of that is it plays in it too. So, and what's it going to cost if we wait 10 years? What is going to be the cost of building those buildings later on? I don't see the dollar recovering more worth. I see it basically becoming less value as it has over the last 30 years.
Yeah, the cost of construction, obviously right now is the time to build. You can get more bang for your dollar. But I'm, you know, both sides of it, with Mr. Crawford and with Mr. Rex, we need these buildings. Some of our schools are falling apart. Do you strap the taxpayers for the next 40 years when you know they wouldn't have voted for those bonds at this point? But, you know, it's tough. It's a tough way to go. Tough decision to make. Mr. Miller.
Well, I'm looking at we're going to get $12 million for the bonds. We're going to pay back $72 million. Is that correct? That's not a very good...
$29 million in today's dollars.
And $72 million over the life of the issue, correct?
I'm sorry?
$72.57 million over the life of that bond issue, correct.
So we're gonna have to pay that back. So that's not a good loan. If
buying a house.
I'm sorry?
It's just like buying a house.
Nobody realizes when they...
That's why we're in the shape we're in now, because people didn't read the small print. What I'm saying, you're somewhat right, but if you read everything that's in there, you should realize that and pay it off as soon as you can. But the situation is, for us, is it worth the school district to pay back the 72 on 12? I don't think it is.
Yeah, the school district's not paying it, the taxpayers are.
The taxpayers of Yuba County.
Yes.
I see your analogy with the buying a house, but I think that's why there's so many foreclosures in Yuba County. You're asking one of the poorest counties in the state of California to assume another debt that they can't afford. And I do not realize it's at the expense of two projects. But... you said you might be able to get one of the projects completed, Mr. Elgar?
Possibly.
Possibly.
Without any bond issuance?
Possibly.
That's good enough for me.
Okay, once we're bumped off that list with those projects, we start at the bottom again. You know, I understand that, and it hurts me because I own more than one piece of property, because it's still based on, you know, whatever. That $60 is based on $100,000 valuation. So it's really hard for me to vote for something that raises my own taxes too, but at the same time, we have an obligation to those kids. It won't take too many lawsuits if a building falls on kids where we're destitute anyway if we don't fix them. Or we don't do that. So,
cool. I don't want to look at the future of lawsuits. I don't think we can look at it that way either.
What if we look at the smaller, the 6.7? Could we get some information on that before we make a final decision?
Yes. It's a short answer, sure.
Okay.
It'll set back the timeline. There is some contingency built into the timeline to issue the bonds, but there isn't a lot. So, yes, and again, that's something Jonathan and I talked about. If the issue is the 40-year term, then what can be done with a 30-year term? Remember, the question before the board is years 31 through 40. It's not 0 through 40.
Right.
It's 31 through 40. And that assumes that we can't refinance it in the future. Of course, again, there's no guarantee that can be done, but it assumes it can't be done.
Okay, but I would like...
And, excuse me.
No, go ahead.
One more clarification. And I realize it's taxpayers paying dollars for this bond issue. The taxpayers are currently paying almost $60 per $100,000 for the existing Measure P bonds. That isn't going to go up.
No, I know.
It gets extended. It doesn't get increased.
Right.
Now,
I
maybe I'm splitting hairs, but...
I understand that.
The current taxpayer doesn't pay anymore.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
Okay.
I really think that's a key point. We're not talking about increasing what the property owners are going to pay. It's we're extending that timeline out by another 10 years. Which is what they agreed to when they passed the bond, was the $60 per, estimated $60 per $100,000 of assessed value.
And if I may again, yes, people's children will be paying for this. But the buildings are going to be there potentially 40, 50, 60, 70 years from now. Well, we're in an 85-year-old building that's been poorly maintained. I submit with some regular routine maintenance, the buildings we build today will last a lot longer than the debt issuance. Okay.
So, Mark, if we go to next board meeting September 11th, get some information that Mr. Harris had asked for, then by the 25th, if we gave you clear direction that night, which way for you and Jonathan to proceed, would that give you time by the 25th?
It extends the timeline. The bonds would be issued about probably in January rather than the end of October, right?
That would certainly be one option to issue. That's probably the latest we can issue in order to secure the state funding. I would say that if we were to get board direction, let's say, I think you mentioned September 11th, or sometime like that, I'd request that maybe we push back the board action item into October, but it wouldn't necessarily need to be pushed back that much. I mean, that's only a few weeks from now. There might be another option or timeline to discuss this with the board. But if some sort of decision or direction was provided in September, I think that maybe just could push us back a month or so. If it was delayed several months, then we really are running out of any
leeway. You would no longer have an action item on September 25th. There simply wouldn't be time to prepare all the legal
documents. So it's only two-week turnaround.
So it would be pushed into October.
I think we need more time. I think we need to look at the other options.
You know, one thing is that our buildings are nice, but a question I get asked weekly, because I'm out working all the time, is about the middle school. I'm getting asked that weekly, what about the new middle school? And it's hard to have answers. They're asking me, they see the other projects, why aren't we getting the new middle school?
The middle school project is due to be submitted to DSA on November the 1st. We decided not to proceed with the design of the middle school until we owned the property. I think everybody's aware of that. We're still moving through the environmental and all the other regulatory requirements on that property, but the plans are due to be submitted to DSA on November 1st. That project will be way down the list by the time it gets all the approvals. It'll be multiple billions of dollars down the state's unfunded list.
Since I wasn't on a board in 2008, I did vote for Measure P. This might sound like an odd question, but it was my impression that we would, at that time, all these projects would be, we had, that was the maximum amount. Our BOGA would be done. What happened in a nutshell to bring us to this moment?
Well, we've given the board lists. We've built, over 90 projects. I mean, we've spent, $120 million. I mean, as projects have come up and been approved and money's available, we've built them. These are simply the next three on the list, so to speak, Arboga, Ella, and Linda. And they are all significant multi-million dollar site-transforming projects. Michelle did give the board copies of some of the site plans, just as a reminder. She is here to help answer any questions, so if the board has any questions about those three projects in particular, we can certainly try and answer them. But I think the short answer to your question, Frank, is, as I said, as the money's become available, we've spent it and we've built things.
These
are just next on the list.
Sure. Right. Thank you.
Okay. What I would like to ask, if this is okay with the board, is could we get a summary of the projected details if we did the 30-year at the 6.7 or whatever it was with the next board packet, the next Friday board packet, or like on September 7th that comes out then? Would that take too long to do that? I mean, would that be... Would you have time to put those numbers together? And that would give us time to come back on the 11th to give direct or clear guidance to which way we want to go.
It sounds like
so we could try to speed the process up some.
So if what I'm hearing from the board this evening is you'd like to see in writing some of the information I've quoted to you about that scenario, the 30-year, what if we capped the bond term at 30 years, we can certainly, that's not a problem to reduce that to writing for your board packet.
Just so we could look at, see the numbers.
For a board communication.
Okay. So at this point is, okay, any other questions? Okay, we'll move on to comments from board members. Mr. Miller. Mr. Rex.
Everything sounds like it's running in the school system, so I haven't had a chance to visit too many areas. I did stop by MCAA once, but all the students looked happy. I'm going to plan to visit more in the next couple of weeks just to see what's going on.
Mr. Fleury.
I have had a chance to visit a few as I drive around, and one of the frustrations that I'm seeing is the new attendance clerk situation. There is a lot of frustration with the attendance clerks, with the people that are doing it, people having to come in early to get their work done. They're not able to get their work done. And I don't know who's going to monitor that, but we need to be aware of that. There's a tremendous amount of frustration.
Mr. Harris.
I'd like to welcome.
Yeah.
Ms. Markle.
Yeah, I was going to welcome Jordan too. You know, I told him earlier in all the years that I've been on the board, I don't think we've ever had a guy.
Did you have him in kindergarten?
No, I didn't. But I had a lot of the others. Is there one other? I just couldn't remember anybody and all. But that's sort of neat. I think we're off to a good start. Everybody's working really hard. There is a lot of construction going on at the various schools, and I've driven around some of the ones south of town and seen what's going on out there. I think the kids are sort of glad to be back in school. The ones I know were bored. They were ready. So, yeah, we're off to a good start.
Mr. Crawford.
I would echo those sentiments. Back to school, literally every school went really smoothly. The kids seem happy, and I agree with you. They seem bored. This is one of the best years I've seen as opening days. So there's some good there. Thank you.
Okay, opportunity for employee organizations to address the board. Marysville Unified Teachers. Do you have anything tonight? No. Operating Engineers Local Union 3. CSEA 326-648, Association Management and Confidential Employees, Supervisory Unit. Public comments, I have four cards tonight. We'll start with Dan Mirzwa. Hopefully I pronounced that right.
Good job. Good pronouncing. Nobody does that.
Thank you. Dan Mirzwa, Yuba County Treasurer, Tax Collector. I first want to address the board actually on behalf of James S. Kennedy, my predecessor, Yuba County Treasurer, Tax Collector. He cannot be here this evening. He did ask me to deliver a letter to the board in regards to the issuance of long-dated caps and their risks. So if I could bring that up to you. Thank you. For the board's pleasure, I had previously written last week after discussions with Mr. Allgaier and GFS as well about this proposed bond structure. It is a position of my association, California Association of County Treasurer and Tax Collectors, as a collective to oppose long-dated capital appreciation bonds such as this one. In addition, I have taken that personally on this issue as well, to oppose this proposed measure. I do believe there are other alternatives that could accomplish the same goals for far cheaper for the district and the taxpayer. So with that, I wanted to prepare a brief piece for you. If you could be so kind to watch a video on this news, as you have asked me questions in regards to what other districts have issued these bonds. There are quite a few. Not too many are on the positive side of the news story. I'd be happy to share these with anyone that would like these, but without further ado, I think this will encapsulate. It's about a 6-minute piece, so please bear with me. Good news is I'm not the Yuba County IT director. If not, do you have internet access?
I can't.
So you didn't know.
This is probably the worst loan ever inside the San Diego School District of Poway, California. It borrowed $105 million to build and remodel schools. Now, that alone is not unusual, except the loan they took will end up costing taxpayers nearly $1 billion to pay back. To repeat, a $100 million loan costing nearly $1 billion over its life. And in just a few moments, we are going to hear from the reporter who broke the story and a major investor about the possible ripple effects. But first, Herb, you helped find this story yesterday. Good work as always. Set the stage.
Well, Brian, look, this is what happens when a municipality does not want to raise taxes but needs to spend a bunch of money. In the case of the Poway School District, the answer was to float a new bond issue, but not just any bond. This is what's known as a capital appreciation bond, which means a free ride today that others will pay for tomorrow. Now, it's the ultimate subprime loan, and it works like this. Poway gets that $105 million today, and it doesn't have to pay a dime for, wait for it, 20 years. Then it starts paying $50 million a year in interest and principal for the next 20 years. So what you've got here is a 40-year loan that is so toxic that the Los Angeles treasurer wrote a letter to school districts last year saying that he will not support any loans like these.
Yeah, Herb, stay right there. This is absolutely inflammatory. So let's bring in Will Careless. He is staff writer at The Voice of San Diego. Will, you broke this story. Do you have any new details on top of what Herb has just told us?
Yeah, it's Carlos, by the way, not Careless. But that's all right. A lot of people made the same mistake.
Well, someone should buy you a car.
I guess the newest details are we've... Okay, fair enough. I've heard it all before, guys. I guess the newest details are that we've started to take a look at some of the other school districts in San Diego County. And, I mean, these are all over the place, these bonds. It's certainly not an isolated incident in Poway. We're seeing bonds at the biggest school district in the county, San Diego Unified, which is the second biggest school district in California, is about more than $1 billion in hock on one of these loans. Other smaller districts have taken out loans with ratios like borrowing $30 million and paying back $260 million in 40 years. So this is all over the place. I think this amounts to billions and billions of dollars all over
Will,
California.
How could it even be allowed? I know that Michigan has banned its school district from issuing this kind of bond. I mean, essentially, you know, you get a free ride today. Our children, our grandchildren are going to get absolutely screwed. Shouldn't this be banned everywhere?
Well, there are people who back this. There are people who think that this is a good idea. And the basic gist of it is, look, we think the property values are going to keep on increasing all over California. It's California, property values never go down. And in the future, this is going to be worth, all the homes are going to be worth a lot more money. And that's going to mean that we're going to be able to pay for this out of our existing taxes. But, I mean, the bottom line is, what we're doing is we're pushing the repayments further and further ahead. We're spending money today and placing the burden on this on future generations. So should it be banned? I mean, I think that the legislature, hopefully here in California, will start to take a look at this. There was legislation pushed last year that was talking about possibly at least making these more transparent so that the school districts would have to at least tell the public what they were going to do and how much this was going to cost. So I'm hopeful we're going to see some changes going forward.
Stay right there. Let's get the investment perspective from Marilyn Cohen. She's president of Envision Capital. She saw some red flags in the district's accounting practices and actually recently decided to get out of all small city bonds. Marilyn, thank you for joining us today. You know what I find absolutely amazing and shocking is that the ratings agencies are not reflecting this financial risk, are they?
They are not. And you hit a big bullseye because most individual investors who may own these Poway capital appreciation bonds look at their monthly statements and they go, oh, Moody's says AA2, S&P says AA-, no problem, and they go off on their merry way. So it is really very disingenuous that people do not understand what's below the surface as far as the borrowing is concerned.
Marilyn, can this be renegotiated? Bonds like this, maybe not just Poway?
I don't know the answer to that other than if it was under a structured bankruptcy, which is what we are seeing in Stockton, California, and, of course, San Bernardino. But, Herb, you know Southern California. Poway isn't a growing megalopolis. It's a school district of 33,000, even if it doubles or triples or quadruples over the 40 years. That's not going to be enough taxes to pay these off. No way.
Well, you know, Marilyn, nobody knows California munis like you. And when you look at, you know, Will mentions he sees more of this in Southern California. As you look throughout the state to your potential investments or some you hold, do you see others like this throughout the state?
I think that's a potential, and I think what really the reason why it is a potential is because of Governor Brown pulling out the redevelopment agency money out from under the cities. And to be very blunt about it, I think that that RDA money was kind of a slush fund in case they needed extra funds. So the you know what hit the fan, Herb, and I think we are going to see more problems like this. I have owned personally, and I've had clients own zero coupon muni bonds, but not due out 30 and 40 years, maybe due out 5 to 10 years, and there is a sequence of payoffs and not big payoffs like we're talking about with Poway.
Will either the school district or whoever accepted and agreed to these bonds was either naive, foolish, or didn't care? Which one do you think it is?
I think naive and foolish.
Will, to you.
Well, I think that what they wanted to do was they wanted to meet their promise to the taxpayers, which was we're not going to increase your taxes. And they did that, right? I mean, they figured out a way to do that. So are they foolish? I mean, a guy told me, one of my sources said, these are either the smartest guys in the world or they're going to cause immense problems. So it's going to be I think it's one of the two extremes.
It's a fascinating story. Thanks for breaking it. Marilyn, Will, Herb, thank you all.
Well, apparently there...
Okay, thank you for that. I do apologize for the length of that. I did want to make a few comments, if there's time, in regards to the proposal you have before you. With that said, obviously, she was one of my coworkers at Cantor Fitzgerald before I came to the county. I have sold, I have purchased, I have structured, and I have traded bonds, municipal bonds at that. Obviously, capital appreciation bonds, zero coupon bonds have been around for some time. Clearly, Michigan has outlawed them. I don't believe a structure per se should be entirely thrown away. Again, it comes to that ratio. We talked about a home loan. That's typically 2-to-1. I would like to point out some of your previous issues because GFS, Mr. Allgaier, Ms. Todd in the district has done a tremendous job with what they have issued previously. I'd like to see that continue, and that's one reason why I wanted to come here tonight. Okay, so the bond ratios is something that Mr. Edwards has done an excellent job in the July 9 presentation about talking about the previous ones. Measure H, the Series 2006 current interest bond, different than the capital appreciation bond, roughly 177. That's inside, because it was inside of 30 years, a typical home loan, a mortgage is about 2-to-1 ratio. You pay back the principal plus interest about twice. 2008, current interest bond, 192. 2009, the current interest component of this very Measure P was 198. Measure P also utilized capital appreciation bonds. 423 is what you can see there. That did keep it inside of the 25 years. That was issued under the Education Code. 25 years is the hard limit on that government code. Obviously, it allows for longer. The proposed measure, and I apologize, at the time that I have this, I did not have the presentation that those changes were as of the July 9 presentation that was at an 8. As we look at it now, it really sits about a 677. So you can see that would still be about over three times what you would be paying on a traditional bond. Essentially in dollars, the same thing we saw in Measure 8, you borrowed 18, you're repaying 31.8. You borrowed 19, repaying 36.4. Borrowed 30.5, repaying 60.5. On the current interest bond, the cabs come in. This is the number that you're looking at that they discussed in that video. You borrowed $3.8 million. You have to repay $12.5 million. Now the proposed, again, these numbers have been changed. We're looking at a 12.5666223 remains the same. However, the total repayment would actually be $85 million. You do have to pay that principal back. With that said, recapture of the 2009. Why did we defer the payments for 25 years in this proposal? There is no debt capacity currently available under Prop 39 due to the previous issuance. So that's one reason why we can't make the payment now, as Mr. Edwards went through. There's a very similar structure that says this is where the proposals would be. Why did we only issue 34 odd million of Measure P originally? Good question. That was because the maximum legal amount of the assessed value could sustain at that time was limited. Otherwise, obviously, we would have issued the entire allotment of 47 million. Since then, where do we see now as opposed to 2009? Many things have changed. Your board, you have talked about that at extensive. How would the taxpayers feel? Would they vote for this now? Would they not? That's an excellent question. The basic principle comes down right there. $1.3 billion has left the tax roll to pay for these bonds. That's a third of the size of the roll before. There it is before you. Now, that is across the county. It's not necessarily just within the school district, which, as we all know, does encompass parts of Butte County as well. So the risks associated with long-dated caps. The risk of the assessed value, AV growth, does not match estimates over the deferred payment period of 25 years. The longer you take that out, the greater that risk is going to be. The risk of AV growth and the collection rate does not match estimates over each fiscal year once debt service has started. That has happened to Marysville Joint Unified School District. I would disagree with Mr. Allgaier in the fact that there are risks to the district as an issuance of GO bonds. In the event you do not collect enough, the district has to come out of operating funds to make that obligation, or they could choose to default on that obligation. Risk that operating and maintenance costs are increased by expansion of additional facilities. Again, that cannot come out of this measure, nor would that come out of state matching funds. That would come out of operating. Deterrence to the structure have been noted by Mr. Edwards previously. The high cost of the funds, the length of the taxation, and the excruciating repayment schedule. That's what was captured in that video. Okay, the risk to whom? The district. Again, we do talk, they will assume some of that risk. The very front end, 25 years, you've got Measure P already laid over there. You will have an inability to over-collect taxes as are placed upon the tax roll because you have current obligations under this structure. The taxpayers are assuming the large portions of this risk. Essentially, what you're asking them to do is pay 3 to 5 times what you normally would ask them with your traditional Measure H or your previous issuance of Measure P. The students. This is where it comes down to. This is why we're all here. It's about the students. The students in this case are actually going to become the taxpayers and the community. That's why we have the schools. That's what we're training them to do, is become useful members of society. The concern here is also the facilities. Obviously, you guys are well informed about how old your facilities are and what state they are. The longer you have those facilities, the more the infrastructure, your HVAC, your networking is going to need to be replaced. That's going to come out of, again, your operating funds. Alternatives, and that was something you guys were discussing before. Obviously, you have a choice not to issue. Perhaps the taxpayers don't like this idea. They may have backed it. Mr. Kennedy, my predecessor, in his letter talked about it. He was a signatory on that measure in 2008 for the 2009 measure. This is something he cannot endorse. Mr. Roper, I believe, has talked to some of you. He also co-signed on this. This is something I'll let him speak for himself on. The issues of less lengthy maturities or a smaller bond, that was something that was discussed that you guys are looking into, so I applaud those efforts. Obviously, the matching funds is a big deal. Do you need all of the measure just because it exists? That saves you cost of issuance. GFS does an excellent job. They're one of the best in the state in reducing cost of issuance. They provide an optimal service in that regard, but saving $110,000 versus costing taxpayers additional $60 million would be considered foolhardy. Exploring issuing another measure. Now we're talking something entirely different. If you went to the voters, again, that would have to be the cost to put that on the measure. You are not constricted by the current 60. Now you could talk again about the traditional current interest bond. That's what SIB's talking about. If you structured that and you wanted to accomplish the same thing with the $22 million, you could achieve the state matching grants depending on your timing. Then you could issue the same $12.5 million. In which case, you do not need an additional 60 per 100,000 of value. You would need something less than that to issue that 12.5. Again, achieving the same matching state grants should those be available. In that, you're going to save the taxpayer when you take that run of 25 years of debt service payments at the initial value, roughly $2,000 in each property. Over the whole, it's $80 million that you would be saving them. So with that, I just wanted to make sure you guys were aware of what the structures were, what the dangers were, both to you, to the taxpayer, and to the students. So if there's any questions, I know I can't take those now. However, I do believe my information should be on the website about how to reach me. I am the county treasurer. I am the de facto treasurer of the school district. Regardless of what position you guys take, I will support that and do the best to maximize that for the district, for the taxpayers. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Dan. Okay, next I have Richard Eberle.
Good evening, members of the board. It's a pleasure and a privilege for me to be here. I'm Richard Eberle, the tax collector, you just heard from him. I'm the auditor controller for Yuba County. It is, like I said, it's a privilege for me to be here this evening and address you. I feel honored to be in your presence. I am a graduate of Marysville High School, and it's a honor for me to give back to the community. I have a presentation tonight, and like my coworker and my colleague at Yuba County, there's some things that came up in the recent past that I was not sure that Mr. Allgaier or the financial advisor GFS, Mr. Jonathan Edwards, were aware of, and so I thought I'd bring this to the board. It is a pleasure from my part to work with professionals such as them. I know that they're doing their dead level best to provide the board and the district the best service that they can. I was concerned with some information that came to my understanding recently, and so I thought I'd bring that to you. My goal is to stay within my allotted time, so I'll do the best that I can with that. I'm here tonight as a parent, as a taxpayer, and also as the auditor controller. As a parent, I have a vested interest in this. My children go to Arbogue Elementary School, and I'm impressed with the instructors. Mr. Preston, the principal, there is an excellent principal, and is carrying on a great tradition that was started by, I believe, Superintendent Todd. Her efforts were commendable, and they have been continued there with Mr. Preston and that administration. In that respect, I do understand the need for additional facilities. A very compelling argument can be made for the need for additional facilities and permanent structures. Most of the buildings out there are portables, and it would be nice for those children to have that, to have those graded facilities. Those additional facilities throughout the district will provide improved learning environments for the students, which is essential for them to be able to get the best education that they can. So as a parent, I completely understand the need, and I agree with it. As a taxpayer, and as has been discussed previously, I'm concerned about the cost of this issuance. As we've seen, we're going to pay back anywhere from as $6 to $8 for every dollar that we borrow. The goal for this issuance, from my understanding and my conversations, has been to secure that $10.5 million in state funding. if it's necessary, then we should do it. But is this the best way to do it? And that's my concern. As you've heard from Mr. Mirzwa and also Mr. Edwards, there's a possibility for other solutions. Those just could possibly be explored a little more in depth. In my role as the auditor controller, I have a couple of interests in here. One of them, the main one, is I put the assessments on the tax rolls for the people, or for the bonds that come up. I am in charge of preparing those calculations for those bond assessments for each parcel. And as Mr. Mirzwa said, and I will echo those statements, as this is a legally approved and voter-approved bond measure, and whatever the board decides to do, if they go ahead with this measure, as my responsibility and my duty, I will put those on there and support that assessment and that collection as my duty as the auditor controller. So I don't want to make it sound like I'm trying to stand in the way of anything like that. So an additional role that I have is to also provide the best information I can to the decision makers in the county. I'm the dispersing agent for many of the funds in the county, for all the funds in the county treasury. And at your direction, I do disperse those funds as needed. And so I feel that I have an obligation to provide those districts with the best information that I have. A couple of things that I'm concerned about, and assuming all the options are that we go ahead with this bond issuance, there's a couple things that concern me. And I'm concerned with the growth assumptions. This information that I've received recently deals with the growth assumptions that are going to be taken into consideration for the ability for the district to repay these bonds. The growth assumptions are limited by the county's general plan. They're also limited by population growth expectation limits from the California Department of Finance, and I'll go into that a little bit later. But also, there's a competition for growth that's going to happen in this area north of Sacramento in the next 25 to 30 years, and I think that you need to be aware of that, because it does affect the district's ability to meet the obligations. First, from the general plan limit, there is a inside the Marysville School District, there's about $3.1 billion in assessed property value, and there's about 26,000 parcels, averages out to be about $99,000, or almost $100,000 per parcel in assessed value. With the projections taken from information received from Mr. Jonathan Edwards, that is projected, according to that 4.5% growth rate, projected to be about $8.2 billion by 2036-37, which is when the first payment will be due. Using that, the same ratio of growth, we expanded the parcel count to help give us a better basis for the assessed value. And those parcels would increase to about 43,000 parcels inside the district boundaries. The average value would increase almost double to $190,000. The first debt service payment is $4.6 million, which would be about $56.77 per $100,000 in assessed value. I want you to note the increase in that, which is about almost 17,000 parcels inside the district boundaries. This is important as we go to the next slide. The current general plan limits growth to about 25,000 buildable parcels in the county. Of those 25,000, approximately 15,000 reside inside the district. So just from a straight buildable standpoint, the general plan limits the ability for the district to grow to meet the expectations. Now, in addition to that, there's their growth boundaries put forth in that general plan. I do want to make mention of the fact that there's an initiative on the November ballot, Measure T, I believe, that addresses the ease with which those district boundaries can be changed. So the passage of Measure T would complicate the ability for those district boundaries or those growth boundaries to be changed to allow for development, which would allow the district to meet its obligations. So there are some concerns I have with that. The Department of Finance estimated in 2007 that the population of Yuba County would be about 137,000 people by 2030, and by 2050, about 200,000 people. Based on new information we've received as of 2012, they've revised those growth estimates, as you can see up there. So by 2035, the year before were supposed to make that payment. It's only grown to $104,000, $105,000. What these growth estimates have done from the Department of Finance is they've pushed back the growth projections about 20 to 30 years for Yuba County. And what that does is it affects the expected growth rate. As we showed before, in the 25,000 buildable parcels, 15,000 buildable inside Marysville School District boundaries, with current population and in the county and also current parcels in the county, there's about 2.2 people per parcel, which is an average based on those numbers. That is a maximum of those 15,000 buildable parcels, a maximum of about 33,000 people that can be, the population can grow inside the district boundaries, when the need is going to be about 37,000. So again, the population growth may not achieve the levels necessary to for these estimates to be able to achieve payback of these bonds in a timely manner. Population growth, as we see, the parcel growth translates into about, like I said, 37,000 people is a projection. That's about 1,500 people per year. And what I did is I took the growth rates over the last almost century. In this next slide, as you can see, in the far right column there, this is the growth rate basically per year by decade. And I want to point out the fact that in the last decade, the 2000 to 2010, the experienced the greatest growth in the history of Yuba County. We added a net total of about 1,200 people to the population per year. If we go back and we see, in order to achieve these growth rates, we need 1,500 people. So the odds are not in our favor, so to speak, to achieve those growth rates. There's also competition for growth, and I wanted to address that. In the next 25 years before the first bond payment is supposed to be made, Natomas and West Sacramento area are working on improving their levees. And so once those levees are constructed, growth will resume in those areas. And there will be competition for growth in Yuba County and also specifically the school district. There's a Sutter Point project in Sutter County that is slated to start in the next 25 years, which will add another 7,000 housing units at minimum projections to housing between Yuba County and Sacramento. This Sutter Point project will exist between at the convergence of 99 and 70 in the southern part of Sutter County. Additionally, and items that were not included in the general plan, is there's an additional growth in South County that's projected. As you saw, those remaining 10,000 those 10,000 parcels that were not inside the Marysville School District growth area exist south in Wheatland and Plumas Lake area. In addition to those 10,000, there's another 10,000 new housing units scheduled to go in Wheatland in the next 25 years. And so those 20,000 units are going to be competing for growth with the Marysville School District. And as we are relying on an agricultural society, but also the main job focus is south of Yuba County, the closer that those houses are to the job areas is going to make it difficult for the assessed value and the demand to grow enough to where we can keep that payment threshold to $60 per $100,000. Just to summarize again, I do know that the need exists. I see that every time I take my kids to school. I do also recognize that this is a huge burden placed on taxpayers. I do appreciate the situation this places you in to address the need with available funds and also matching state grant money. It's a very tough situation, and I do appreciate the tough situation that you have. This does, with the competition, affect the ability for the district to for the county, the citizens of the county, to repay those bonds at their projected rates. I have a question slide, so if you have any questions, need for clarification, I also have additional slides after that, which will do some projected growth rates. And I say that because, as Mr. Mearswell alluded, in the event that in any given year that the bond collections, the assessment collections, are not sufficient to repay the bond, that the district will have to come out of operating funds, out of the general fund, in order to pay those back. That has happened in the recent past. It was an amount of approximately, I believe, $10,000 to $15,000 that had come out. That will be made up in the assessments in the following year. But there is a risk that in any given year the collections will not be sufficient to make those payments. And before I do that, if you have any questions, and if you'd like me to go into those additional, for additional clarification, what those potential risks may be, I'd be happy to do that.
I don't think we can legally ask you any questions.
Clarification questions only are fine.
And that's fine. And if you have a desire to, if you have a burning desire to learn, to have that information, I can leave some information with you, and I'd be more than happy to give you my card. You can contact me. I'd be more than happy to share that with you. So any questions you have for me or clarifications?
No questions at this time.
Thank you.
Mr. Boone?
Yes.
Mr. Everly, I did make a statement, so, I mean, our goal tonight is to give the board accurate information, and I did say there was no fiscal risk to the general fund. Mr. Everly is correct in that, and my understanding of the law is if there is a shortage in 1 year, then in essence we would front fund the money to be made up in the subsequent year. This has happened one time. I believe the amount was $14,000 to $15,000, and we had the money back, I believe, within a month. So I do want to correct what I said. What Mr. Everly said is correct. However, again, my understanding is that the county is obligated by law to levy the taxes sufficient to make the debt service on the bonds, and if in the event of a shortage, that we would, in essence, have to front, the county would be obligated to levy sufficient taxes so that we were repaid.
And thank you, Mr. Thank you for that clarification. I did not mean to say that you misspoke. I just wanted... I wanted to make sure there was a clarification. So yeah, that is correct. And Mr. Allgaier is also correct. In any instance where there is insufficient collections, the next time that those bond rates are calculated, they will be that will be figured in, so additional collections will be necessary. That does potentially put the... there is the potential for those assessments to exceed $60 per $100,000 in those types of situations. So there is that risk as well. But as Mr. Allgaier pointed out, that happened just once in the past, and he's absolutely correct. So I wanted to make sure that the board was aware of those risks.
If I may add some further clarification to Mr. Allgaier's comment on this particular item, again, to make sure that this is a very important issue, the district's liability, so I do want to make sure that as much information as possible is disclosed on that. The district has no legal liability make up any shortfall in the bond payment. The district has, in a prior year, done so in order to keep things flowing smoothly, which certainly we want to do. We don't want a bond payment to fall short, but there is no legal liability to do so. At the time this happened, there was quite a discussion with predecessors at the county about the liability for those funds, because under Government Code 15250, the county is required to levy the tax sufficient to pay debt service on the bonds. Nevertheless, the school district did address that at that time, but there is no legal liability to do so. In addition, I think one of the reasons that particular incident occurred was that at the time there was, I think, a slight miscommunication with the prior auditor controller's office about exactly the tax collection methodology employed. That has subsequently been corrected through very good communications with Mr. Eberly, and we are incorporating a delinquency factor for this year. It's 10% tax delinquency assumption. In the future, in future years, the current plan assumes a 9% tax delinquency assumption. The worst it ever got in the county at the absolute bottom of the economy, I think in 2008-2009, was at slightly over 10%. If the data is correct. And even though we are still in challenging times, it has come down materially since then. I think it's most recently 5 or 6%, maybe a tad lower in terms of delinquency. So we have built in a delinquency coverage factor. It was the delinquencies that caused the taxes to come up short years ago. So I just want to add that. Hopefully we've mitigated any material risk there.
Just wanted
If I could clarify that conversation about the delinquency rate, Mr. Edwards is correct. 2008, it was in excess of 10%. However, that is not the only reason that would actually draw funds out. The shrinkage that we've seen in the assessed valuation itself is when that tax is levied and placed on the bill is when you would have that pro rata versus a collection rate. As you've seen over the last 5 years, the roll has actually shrunk. There are alternate methods for that to happen in a tax year. Roll corrections and roll changes can happen, as well as assessment appeals, which have happened. There's still 300 waiting to be heard from prior fiscal years, 500 waiting to be heard for last fiscal year. So the number of those and the risk associated with those is greater than just a collection percent itself. So I do want to make you aware of that, because that rate is actually projected before the year starts, or in August. Then the collection happens, first installment December 10, as you know. April 10 is the second, so we continue to collect those all the way through June 30. However, you do have a two-pronged risk there. So I do want to clarify that. That way you do know some of it was actually the rate. The other portion you are going to receive. We do not teeter these, so as such, you receive prior fiscal years as those are collected. That should help mitigate that risk. However, that collection percentage is much higher. In return, you do receive the 18% interest on that. It's 1.5% a month. So do you want to make sure you're aware of that, too. Thank you.
Okay, next public comment card is Wren Kirkpatrick.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the board. This is my first board meeting. I am an alumni of Marysville High School, year 91-92. I am the father of 7 children that attend 4 schools in the district, and I am the youth pastor for the East Linda Pentecostal Church of God, and I mentor and supervise between 12 and 20 other students that attend in the district. There is a issue at hand that I have tried to resolve through other methods, and I'm bringing it before you to get your input and your feedback and maybe a resolution through you. I'm a little confused as to the protocol regarding these meetings, so I will try to keep my comments short and up to 3 minutes, but I can't promise anything either. I didn't bring anything, but I am the IT director for Yuba County. Just kidding. But, okay, basically what it comes down to is my son is beginning Marysville High School this year as a freshman. Very proud and honored that my son is going to the same school I graduated from. And I also have a son in Lyndhurst High School, both on the football team. I decided to take a jersey and sew it in half for the games. With 7 boys in the house, we have very strict rules and guidelines regarding snacking and eating and homework and chores and yada. It's a military camp in essence. And when my child comes home from Marysville High School and I find him hoarding and sneaking food into his room because he claims to be starving, I think he's blowing smoke up my butt, to be honest with you, for lack of a better term. So I reprimand him and I tell him, listen, quit socializing with your friends, get to school, eat your breakfast, get to class. During break you can socialize, during lunch if you don't want to eat, that's your fault, your decision, whatever. Come to find out Marysville High School, upon research, and I have a list here, and I have taken this to the principal of Marysville High School as well as the district's nutritionist. I can submit this for evidence, for lack of a better term, Exhibit A. Lyndhurst High School offers 50 minutes before academics for students the opportunity to gain nourishment. Yuba City High School, 30 minutes plus 10 minutes during the nutrition break. Live Oak High School, 75 minutes. Wheatland High School, 50 minutes. Albert Powell High School is only 15 minutes, but it is a very small campus, very centrally located, and the food is brought into them. T.E. Matthews, which is pretty much the last resort, last-ditch school in our district, provides 55 minutes. The Bicanny Juvenile Hall provides 30 minutes to the inmates to provide nourishment before academics begin. Marysville High School provides none. at all. I addressed this with the principal. I took it to the nutritionist, and I asked why. And they said, well, we provide an alternate method of providing nourishment to the children, and that is during their break period, which has been adopted by other schools in both this district and the Yuba City district. The problem is the period for the student to obtain the federally regulated guideline for nourishment that the school district is reimbursed for is 10 minutes. Now, I don't know, you sir, what was your name? The last speaker right there, what was your name?
Rich Emerly.
Mr. Emerly, you're an alumni of Marysville High?
Yes.
Okay, so you're aware that the lockers way over by the ball field and the cafeteria is way over here. I'm challenging the board to take into consideration the realistic expectation of a student to be dismissed from a second period class, to travel from possibly a class that is located on one side of a 100-acre campus to the point where he can receive nourishment, wait in line with a student population of somewhere around 1,000, if I'm not mistaken, with two windows open, obtain his or her food, and get back to his or her third period class. They do have a 5-minute passing bell, so it's a total of 15 minutes from release to tardy. When do the children have a chance to eat and swallow? That's my concern. Now, I've compared some data. One is an example. This is from Mary DeLong, who is the director of the Student Nutrition and Warehousing for the Yuba City Unified School District. And she provided me with the options that are available for the Yuba City Unified School District's River Valley High School and Yuba City High School menu options, availability times. And I've also contacted the California Department of Education and obtained a minimum and maximum for federal reimbursement through the, let's see, where is it here? Sorry, again, this is my first time, so bear with me. It's attached to the back. Under Senate Bill 3307, Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010, the guidelines are here. The minimum caloric intake for a federally reimbursed breakfast meal, the minimum for grades 9 through 12 is supposed to be 450 calories. On Monday, my student was issued this. It is a Trix cereal bar, a half pint of chocolate milk, and a package of string cheese. A total of 320 calories. This was all that was available to him. On Friday, this was not available to him. I met with the assistant principal, I met with the district office here in this building, and by the time my son was released, I was waiting for him on his last period class. They made an announcement 2 minutes before the dismissal of class on Friday that a grab-and-go lunch will be available for all students effective Monday. That was yesterday. If the students so elect to use this as their nourishment until lunch, they are ineligible for the federally allowed allotment that is provided here at the break period, if they're able to obtain it. What I'm asking in essence is the School Nutrition Association has a meal pattern recommendation for school breakfast. It's not unreasonable, and I'm not saying that I take great pride in Marysville High School. I'm an Indian true and true. My son is an Indian, and I have six other boys on their way. My boys are not just my concern. It's the student body in whole. There's 1,000 students, and as we have clearly defined, this county has a higher propensity for low-income families. The children that I mentor and the children that I minister to, a great deal of them come from broken homes, foster homes, surrogate living situations, drug abuse, gangs, juvenile halls, a number of mitigating circumstances that the only opportunity that these students have, or that the people that are responsible to provide for them, are under the assumption that you get breakfast at school, you get lunch at school, we provide you with a healthy dinner, and your nutritional needs are met. Unfortunately, with the current policies and the current schedule that is established at Marysville High School, that's simply not being met. Now, I've looked up Education Code 49490, Article 7, and that references the school breakfast and lunch programs. And the legislature finds that and declares that hunger and malnutrition among children from low-income families constitute one of the most critical child health problems in the state. The federal programs to meet child nutrition needs are providing nourishing meals to thousands of the state poverty area children who previously could not participate in school lunch programs. That federal fund allocated for child nutrition to California are inadequate to meet critical needs, that the state and local communities bear a responsibility toward meeting these needs, and that the physical well-being of all the children of the state is a matter of public concern, and expenditures to secure such well-being serves a public purpose. Now, that's enacted by in 1976. Now, the Marysville Joint Unified School District Board Policy, Board Policy Number 3553, free and reduced price meals, and this is taken directly off the MSJUD website. The Board of Education recognized that adequate nutrition is essential to child development and learning, and that some families may be unable to provide breakfast and lunch for their children. In accordance with law, the district shall provide nutritionally adequate, free, and reduced price meals for students whose families meet federal eligibility criteria. Now, I'm not standing here attacking Marysville High School, nor am I attacking the district. I'm simply petitioning the board for a modification of the schedule for Marysville High. Now, since I have brought this issue up, I have gained a little ground, and they're offering a grab-and-go breakfast from 7:30 a.m. until 7:50 a.m. when the first bell rings for the first period class. And then they offer the federally mandated amount of nourishment to be offered in a 10-minute period between second and third period. We're the only school, and I have lists of the intermediate schools. None of them have less than 20 minutes before classes where they receive the full amount. I've called all the elementary schools. None of them have less than 20 minutes before academics for the little tykes to receive their nourishment before classes. I'm an ex-felon. In prison, they give you 20 minutes to eat. All I'm petitioning this board is that the current schedule be flip-flopped. Give the children the opportunity in the morning before academics from 7:30 to 7:50, because obviously that's not going to take away from the availability of staff, nor the availability of the food. It's not going to cost the county any money. It's not going to cost the board any money. And actually, the proposed legislation right here that Obama has said, it's going to make the county some money, the district some money. We get an additional 6 cents per student per meal, per day, if we come into compliance with the minimum allowable standards. If you do the math, it's about $1,200 a day. It's making the district money. Flip it around, give the kids a chance to eat from 7:30 to 7:50, and then if they take part of that meal, they're not eligible for the grab-and-go snack at 10 o'clock. But yet this would serve a valid purpose for the children that are off-site doing ROP or doing alternate location classes, or the children that arrive tardy and yet still need a little bit of something in their belly to get through until lunch. So So it would serve the same purpose, but the order is backward. And since I run a community website as well, and since I have posted my concern on this, and I've worked on it for the last, I don't know, 4 days, pretty much. I got off work, I came here, I watched my son at football practice, and I came over here to bring it to the people that, honestly, I feel have the children's best interests at heart. When I hear about projects for Ella and I hear about projects for Linda, my children have attended there. And it, you know, we don't have to worry about lawsuits until the buildings fall down. That's not my department. My department is being a father. My department is being a taxpayer and a member of this community. And unfortunately, I can't enact the policy changes. And with 7 children at home, working full time, I don't know about you guys, but boys eat. We qualify for reduced lunch. Our economic standard is not up to where, I mean, the federal poverty limit for a family size of 9 is astronomical. And in this area, it's simply not a possibility for my family anyway. Since I've reached out to the community and I've reached out to the Appeal Democrats community reporter, I'm receiving a lot of communal support on this. And I would urge you, oh, and by the way, and this is what was served for the second day. They did have the option of yogurt and string cheese as well. But this is simply not enough to feed a senior at high school if his parents can't afford to feed him. And my kid's only a freshman. He's a big boy. But I would, you know, throw this petition on the discretion of the board and simply ask for a simple schedule change for Marysville High School to give the children the opportunity, and a lot of them are going to turn it down anyway. The rebuttal I received when I said, well, when I went to school, we had breakfast here. And when my niece went to school, we had breakfast here. We had the option of it. And the person in charge said, well, we tried to institute that and only 6 children showed up. So we just did away with it. And I stopped and I thought, I said, well, what about those 6 kids? Is it fair to those 6 kids that they no longer have the option? I don't think it is. So that's pretty much the end of my presentation. Sorry about the length of my time.
Okay, thank you. I have one more public comment card, Doyle Smith.
Hi, my name is Doyle Smith, and I work for the Carpenters Unions of Northern California, and I also reside in Plumas Lake. And tonight I'm here to talk to you about opportunities for students for the school district and also the county. And what I mean about that is apprenticeship. And the Carpenters Union offers apprenticeship language, which is state-certified labor management. It's also regulated by the state. And it's a 4-year program, which consists of 17 different 1-week classes and also 4,800 hours on the field training. And with that, they also get raises for every 600 hours out in the field and 2 classes in every 6 months. They get automatic raises, so they earn as they learn. And how can we do this is to have contractors, responsible contractors, come in that bids on projects here that pays into a state-certified apprenticeship program like this. And with this being said, this will also help the community, as I know a lot of you folks are concerned about the students falling through the cracks, you know, does it make it, trying to get them back on track. Like a lot of people that's in juvenile hall, when they're in prison, they want to get back on their feet, get back. This is another opportunity for them. And also with this apprenticeship program, they also offer college credits through Los Rios Community College. So say they go out to work, they don't like doing this, maybe they want to go out and become an architect. Well, they can take what the classes they've had here and they can apply it to Los Rios Community College and have an AA in construction. And that breaks down a little bit further, which I can explain later on. But basically, what I'm trying to say is get some kind of language to where a contract comes in bids on a project that does pay into a state-certified apprenticeship program. And also, I am working with the Yuba County Youth Build with Scotia Sanchez and Sandy Waterhouse. They want to adopt our pre-apprenticeship program, which that means if they adopt our pre-apprenticeship program, they have a direct entry into our pre-apprenticeship program, which is a six-week course. It's non-paid, but it's like a boot camp, so to speak. Can they handle it? Do they want this work? Can they last? But once they make it through there and they graduate, they get a full set of hand tools and a tool bag. They can go out and hustle up work. And the reason why we're trying to do this, we're working closely, we almost got it with the pre-apprenticeship program with Sandy. But without that, if they don't have any work for the students here or in the community, it's not going to work. You're going to have these students, they're going to graduate and they're going to come back here and have no job. So if the school district allows some language into it where a contractor comes in and bids, say like $100,000 and up on a project that's required for state, they can hire here, I guess. I'm kind of a little off. Sorry, I left my bullet points at work, so I'm a little off. Anyways, they can require local hire, a certain percentage, basically maybe 25% or whatever. That's up to the board. And I don't know. Basically, what I'm trying to say is if we have responsible contractors coming here, we can get some students to work from local, bring local hire to work. And with the youth build, that'll also help along too. Does anybody have any questions? Any clarification? I know a little sideways on it, but I can meet with each one of you to explain a little bit more in depth.
Do you have a proposal that you can drop off at the district and we could review?
I do. I do have a brochure. I think I've met with most of you. I've talked about it, and I've talked with several of you.
Maybe if you drop it off at the superintendent's office, we could review it individually.
Yeah, and I believe I met with Mrs. Todd here and Mark Ogall on the subject, and I met with a lot of you folks, but I will bring it in. Most definitely. Anything else?
Thanks, Doyle.
All right.
Okay, superintendent's report, Dr. Todd.
Well, as Mr. Crawford mentioned, and Mr. Rex, school has started, and our enrollment is a little up, but we're still waiting for a few of those numbers to settle down as our high schools start to drop some of the students who have not shown. But right now we're sitting at 9,595 students. We also have a new subgroup of students that have entered our doors, and that is the transitional kindergarten students. And those are the children who have a birthday date of November 1st. And right now we currently have 51 students who have shown up for the two-year program. So it is really kind of fun to see. We have a number of teachers who are really excited to be able to expand and do some of the developmental things that a lot of the kids have not had, and certainly there are a number of students who don't qualify for preschool, so this is really nice that we are able to provide them with that experience, and I believe we will see a great return on this when they get to second grade and start taking some of the testing, because they'll be really ready for it, and I think we will be better for that. Next year, we'll be looking at dropping that age down to October and possibly even September 1st. So there'll be a whole group of kiddos coming through and beginning their journey as they march through to the high school age. You may have seen an article in the newspaper last Friday, which was the morning of my State of Education for the district at the Yuba Sutter Chamber of Commerce breakfast. It was talking about Lyndhurst High School and the fact, I'm not wondering, I'm getting lots of echo. Is it just, thank you. Talking about what's going on in education, there were 7 guest speakers there. Yuba City Unified was there, Brandman University, Yuba College, a whole host of other folks. And bless Bob Harlan's heart, he had to ask me about the article in the newspaper about Lyndhurst High School only scoring 70% on the high school exit exam for the sophomores, their first try at the test. But you know me. I had a great time with Bob because he said to me, "Gay, is this because we have a lot of second language learner students out at Lyndhurst High School, and it does take them a number of times to actually get enough academic English behind them so they can score well on the test?" And so I had to tell Bob, "Well, yes, obviously you've been listening during all of those interviews we've been doing over the years, and that is exactly what is happening." And I shared with the group that I am also pleased to say that although they start out at a 70%, we have 95% of our students who actually graduate from Lyndhurst High School, and they have passed the high school exit exam. So all of our efforts to help shore up their second language learner designation and to give them extra help with the high school exit exam really does, in fact, pay off. So they start a little low, but they finish really strong. So just wanted to give you that little piece of information. Had a great drop-in visitor yesterday, Janet Siller. Came by my office, and Janet and I go way back to my days at McKinney when she was running Friday Night Live, and the kids love going to those dances. And Janet has been back with Friday Night Live for a couple of years, but she's now reestablishing some connections with our district. And specifically, they are going to be taking a student from, hopefully, if the board gives me the nod. They didn't quite meet the timeline for taking students on a field trip. We have one student that they would like to take to the Youth Leadership Summit in Anaheim, September 14th through 17th. It's a Lyndhurst High School student, as I said. And unless you have issues with letting this young man go, I know he'll be in very good hands, and they promised to get me the paperwork prior to the field trip, but it just didn't have time to make it onto the agenda. So I'm guessing you're going to be fine with that, and I told her I kind of thought that as well. And then just one last thing, a reminder that tomorrow, August 29th at 5 p.m. in the Quivalod Multipurpose Room, the City of Marysville Parking and Traffic Committee will be meeting and talking about some of the safety issues in and around that school. We are also pleased that we went and met with, or went to the City Council meeting where they did agree to close 7th Street, the street that runs through Quivalod, once we begin construction, which we're not sure when that'll be, but they have agreed to close that street down so that it will all be part of Quivalod School and we won't have traffic running through the middle of that campus. So I thought that was a great support from our city, and certainly one that we are excited about because it does allow us to design a more comprehensive program and put buildings where they should be and not just where they have to be because of space limitations. And so with that, that is the end of my report.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Todd. We'll move on to approval of minutes. Minutes from the regular board meeting of August 14th, 2012. If there are no additions or deletions, is there a motion?
Make motion to approve.
Motion by Mr. Crawford. Is there a second? Second by Ms. Markle. All those in favor?
Aye.
Seven yes. Consent agenda. Does anybody want anything pulled on the consent agenda? If not, is there a motion?
Move for approval.
Is there a second?
Second.
Oops. Second by Mr. Fleury, that was. And all those in favor?
Aye.
Seven yes. Okay, the only new business is the proposed charter for Paragon Collegiate Academy Charter School, and that has been pulled.
Yes, I met with the principal, Lisa Reese, talking about some of the areas where there are some gaps in information, and Paragon Collegiate Academy has voluntarily pulled their application for 30 days, at which time they will come back, and it will be on the agenda for action by the board.
Okay, that's the last item on the agenda. I believe Mr. Crawford wants to close the meeting in honor of somebody.
I would like to adjourn tonight in the memory of a former student of mine who took his life tragically Saturday, named James Cooper, wonderful young man. Goes back to the troubles we talk about all the time, and teen suicide, and this is another casualty. So in his memory, I'd like to adjourn this meeting. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Crawford. The meeting's adjourned.